Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Resolution's interim 2011 results presentation. Please, could I ask you to either turn your phones, BlackBerrys, off or onto silent as we move through this morning's presentation? After these few words from me, John will take us through the business review, Jim through the numbers, and then Andy will spend a little time talking about building the business for the future. Then we'll move to questions and answers. With that, I'll hand you over to John.
Thank you very much, Michael, and good morning. Let's get this going. The first half of 2011 is the first reporting period during which Resolution has owned both Friends Provident and AXA's U.K. life business. Bupa Health Assurance has been part of the group for 5 months during that six-month period. During the first half, we announced the three-year strategy and financial targets for Resolution's life consolidation project, launched a new brand name for the business, Friends Life, announced the cash and capital framework together with a planned return of capital of 500 million pounds by the middle of 2012, and appointed a new CEO of Friends Life. Alongside these important decisions necessary to position the project for success, we have continued to work with the Friends team to strengthen the capability through the organization, ensure the appropriateness and transparency of underlying models and assumptions, and achieve the cost synergies brought about through the creation of the enlarged group. Results for this first half year, therefore, reflect an organization in transition, transition towards a focused, integrated, and robust business. These results contain strong evidence that the strategy and the path to achieving our financial targets are on track. Firstly, the U.K. new business returns on the platforms on which we have chosen to write new business in the future are already close to or in excess of the target returns we've set for 2013. The turnaround in the U.K. is in the early stages, as evidenced by the rise in the value of U.K. new business in the first half of 2011 to 28 million pounds compared to 20 million pounds in the equivalent period of 2010. Secondly, the run rate cost savings of 24 million pounds achieved by 30 June are in line with our expectations, and Friends are on track to achieve or exceed the full-year synergy target. Thirdly, the cash and capital position remains robust, with further capital synergies to emerge in the second half year and the potential for further capital optimization thereafter. Fourthly, the international businesses, including Lombard, FPIL, and the German OLAB and FPB businesses, are positioned to contribute meaningfully to the returns of the project. Lombard has had its second-best first half year ever, following the outstanding performance in the comparable period last year, while FPIL continues to achieve market success in the countries in which it operates. We have been working hard to ensure its operating systems and financial models are fit for purpose for the future. Fifth, the group's balance sheet is positioned defensively. Exposure to sovereigns of the so-called PIGS countries, together with banks in those countries, amounts to approximately 2% or 0.2 billion of the 9 billion of shareholder funds. At our February strategy update conference, I committed to updating shareholders every 6 months on the progress towards the 2013 financial targets, and this is the first such update. Based on the actions we have taken during the period and those planned in the future, we remain confident that the group will achieve these targets. I'll move in a moment to disaggregate the metrics for cost savings and new business returns so that the sources of profitability are set in the context of our strategy, while Jim will later analyze the cash position and the basis of our MCEV returns in the first half year. Cost synergies are coming through as expected. Initial cost savings are primarily in the sales and marketing areas where teams have been merged and office closures announced. Sales and marketing teams operating under the unified brand of Friends Life are responsible to a refocused management team. While there are further cost savings to be realized in the sales and marketing functions, the focus is now very much on operations, support, customer service, and IT. The business is streamlining the IT infrastructure and assessing opportunities for further outsourcing. A number of internal announcements have been made concerning the office location of critical internal support functions such as finance. So we are confident that the glide path to securing total synergies of $112 million by the end of 2013 will be delivered, and that the cost to achieve these savings will be within our original disclosed estimates. Turning now to new business performance. Friends Life has chosen the Bupa Health Assurance, the BHA platform, for its new business in the protection market. All targeted IFA business will be migrated to the enhanced platform by the end of this year. And we are working with the group's major control distribution partners to achieve migration during the course of the next 18 months. Extending control distribution relationships is a key component of the protection strategy, and we were very pleased to announce in February a broadly based relationship with the AA. The BHA platform achieved an IRR on new business written in the 5 months to 30th of June 2011 of 26%. Our 2013 target from the combined individual protection business is 20%. Looking forward, we anticipate that APE will reduce from the 2010 levels as Friends focuses more selectively in the market. But the value of new business, VNB, will continue to grow as new business strain reduces and it concentrates on higher margin critical illness and income protection products. We believe that overall, the protection market has held up well in difficult economic circumstances and that distribution opportunities may open up further as the RDR becomes effective in 2013. Friends Life has chosen the new generation pension platform, the NGP, for its new business in the corporate pensions market. This platform delivered credible results in the first half, generating VNB of £11 million and an IRR of 8.8% against the 2013 target of 10%. The NGP platform is being enhanced to accommodate the transfer in 2012 of 150,000 members and £3.5 billion of assets from the Embassy platform that was operated by AXA. Overall, corporate pension assets under management have grown by £1 billion to £18 billion. Increments to existing schemes have been strong, and 40 new schemes have been won. The pipeline is strong, and with a notable presence of single premium business and high quality schemes. We believe the corporate benefits market will continue to grow during the next several years as DB schemes continue to close and new DC schemes emerge. Auto-enrollment is introduced and the RDR broadens out the corporate market to include other products. Friends Life's corporate pensions book also provides an attractive source of future annuity business for our growing annuity activity. Which leads me on to retirement income. Our strategy in the annuity market is to grow the capture of Friends Life vesting pensions through offering policyholders more sophisticated propositions and to develop new capabilities to support Friends Life's participation in the open market. These include investments that we are currently making in sophisticated mortality analysis, new customer management systems, and enhanced credit risk management. We believe that the macro trends in the UK will continue to drive a larger profit pool from retirement income products. The OMO market will continue to grow, and impaired annuities will occupy an increasing share of the total market. We are seeking to position our offering to benefit from these trends and also benefit from the withdrawal of capacity in recent years, and which may continue as Solvency II imposes tougher capital requirements. Sales of annuities in the first half year were £19 million of APE, driven by internal vestings with a guaranteed annuity option where margins tend to be lower. Consistent with the growth in the OMO market, retention rates as a percentage of vesting funds were just down slightly from 2010. VNB was £16 million and the IRR was 23.8%. Lombard continues to make good progress in the high net worth individual estate planning market. However, VNB and operating profit before tax on an MCEV basis have both fallen in comparison to the first half of 2010, which saw an exceptional performance driven by the European Savings Directive and the Italian tax amnesty. IRR on new business has remained strong at 19%, and assets under management are up 23% from just a year ago. While recent activity may have been adversely affected by market volatility, we continue to believe that there will be inherent long-term demand for Lombard's estate planning solutions. Lombard is investing to capitalize on these market opportunities through a strengthening of its international sales force, a deepening and tailoring of its relationship with key distribution partners, and enhancing policy servicing systems. New markets, such as those in Asia, performed promisingly in the first half, and we see further growth potential in this region, where the estate planning sector is still relatively embryonic. The international business continued to succeed in growing new business in its major markets of Hong Kong, Singapore, and the Middle East, while it's encountered some headwinds in Germany. Overall, AP is up 10% on the same period last year, while VNB and IRR are down due to modeling and assumption changes processed in the second half of 2010, and which overstated the first half-year results in 2010. As I mentioned earlier, all models and assumptions have been critically assessed to ensure they are prudent and appropriate to the earnings profile of the business being written. The group has continued to invest in the international business in order to improve profitability and improve persistency, and to achieve, therefore, the 2013 financial targets of new business IRR at 20% and sustainable cash generation of 20 million pounds per annum. So before handing over to Jim, I'll just close with a few comments on acquisitions and exit. The outlook with regard to future acquisitions remains the same as I described at the 7th of June cash and capital update. We continue to maintain a dialogue with market participants, and although the bar to acquisitions remains high, we would consider transactions which do not require a rights issue and which are accretive to returns and shareholder value, and also help achieve our strategic positioning in the market. The resolution team continues to study the options for exiting the Life project in accordance with our original timetable of 3 to 5 years from the launch of the project in November 2009. To remind you, the four options that we set out previously are: one, a cash sale, together or in parts; two, a direct listing of Friends Life Group as a standalone entity; three, the separation of UK open business from back book, leading to separate sales or listings; and four, a merger of Friends Life Group or a separated UK open business with another life company. While the option or combination of options which ultimately delivers an exit from the project will depend on prevailing market opportunities and market circumstances, we are very actively analyzing and assessing each option. Overall, we are encouraged by the improvement in the operational performance of the U.K. business in the first half of 2011, and which underpins our confidence in the U.K. Life project as a whole. I now pass over to James.
Thank you, John, and good morning, everybody. As John has already outlined, we are beginning to see some positive improvements from the new business strategy that we announced in February. These results, however, still primarily reflect the characteristics of the original businesses we acquired and the investment we're making to stabilize, separate, and integrate them. Progress on cash delivery and capital synergies has been made in addition to the green shoots that John has already outlined, and this can be seen very clearly from our core KPIs. The IFRS operating profit, while up 158% in the first half of the year, primarily reflects the benefit of capital synergies, with the underlying result consistent with 2010. MCEV operating profit, flat with last year, reflects the lower value of new business in the first half of 2011, primarily in Lombard, the non-recurrence of positive operating variances seen last year, and the low rates of return currently achievable on net assets. Overall, MCEV is also broadly flat, with the value delivered in the first 6 months being returned to shareholders through the dividend and the commencement of the share buyback programme. Group IGCA surplus and group available shareholder cash are both at lower levels than at the end of 2010. This is primarily as a reflection of the return of cash to shareholders too, and this is ahead of the year-end release of surplus from the life companies. And finally, the interim dividend of 6.47 pence per share represents an 18% increase on last year, in line with the guidance of a 15% increase that we gave for the preliminary results and adjusted for the impact of the share buyback. In the following presentation, I'll give a quick run-through of the key elements that have driven these metrics. But before I do, as always, a quick reminder of the basis of the results. Bupa Health Insurance was acquired in January this year, and accordingly its results are only included for 5 months. I think most of you are familiar with the acquisitions we've made and will recognise that the half-year 2010 comparatives only include the acquired Friends Provident business and Resolution Holding entities. Moving on then to the business performance and IFRS operating profit. IFRS-based operating profit for the 6 months ended 30th of June was £390 million, due partially to the beneficial impact of utilising negative reserves through the implementation of PSO 614 as part of our capital optimisation programme. The benefit of this implementation to the in-force result in the period was £201 million, comprising of a one-off benefit of £221 million, offset by a reduction in the in-force surplus for the 6 months of £20 million. We expect a similar reduction of £20 million in the second half of this year. The overall impact on 2011, therefore, excluding new business, is expected to be in the region of £180 million. This is an increase of £30 million on the guidance that we gave at our Cash and Capital Day in June, primarily due to the differences on the grossing up of cash flows. The impact of this benefit to IFRS-based operating profit is largely removed at the IFRS profit after tax level due to accelerated amortisation of the acquired value of in-force business, reflecting the advancement of profits. The IFRS operating result before these capital synergies was £189 million. This is broadly in line with the normalised profit of £366 million for 2010 we reported as guidance, again on our Cash and Capital Day in June. We've seen some reduction in new business strain, partially offset by lower earnings from the long-term investment return. If we look at this briefly, the long-term investment return, the gross return has only increased slightly from £39 million at the half-year 2010 to £43 million in June. This despite an increase in average assets over the same period from approximately £1.6 billion to £2.6 billion. This reflects a reduction in long-term rates and shift in assets away from bonds to cash held at holding company level. Over the same period, the long-term debt held by the Friends Life Group has significantly increased, due to the funding taken out to support the acquisition of the ex-AXA businesses. Overall, this results in a net loss from the long-term investment return of £14 million, compared to an income of £17 million in the first 6 months of last year. At the profit after tax level, IFRS profit for the first 6 months was £45 million. After operating profit, the major impacts were the accelerated amortisation of AVIF as a result of the adoption of PSO 614, as we already outlined, and the amortisation of AVIF for the period. To assist with forecasting future AVIF amortisation charges, a schedule of expected amortisation adjusted for this accelerated element is included as an appendix to this presentation. It also includes an update to reflect the amortisation in respect of the BHA acquisition. Non-recurring costs in the first half year arise from our investment in the future of the business. The largest element of this was a £41 million charge for the cost of separation and integration, which remain in line with our previous expectations. We also incurred £24 million in respect of Solvency II and finance transformation costs. This investment has been made to ensure we're able to deliver the requirements of Solvency II and also to transform the finance system's infrastructure to a more robust base, enhancing our capability for financial and economic risk management. Finally, the credit for shareholder tax was somewhat larger than might be expected. This is due to a £48 million one-off tax credit from the release of a unit-linked tax provision, a £30 million tax credit from the reduction in the rate of UK corporation tax, and from the £68 million accounting gain on the acquisition of BHA being non-taxable. Moving on then to MCV, operating profits on an MCV basis are broadly in line with our expectations, other than for a negative operating variance of 16 million in the international business. This primarily arises from modeling corrections identified by a review undertaken as part of our finance transformation program. The MCV result also reflects lower first half sales in Lombard, as already outlined by John. Expected existing business contribution, or EEBC, for the 6 months was 181 million. This compares to an annualized figure of 381 million for the full year 2010. This would imply a small reduction, approximately 10 million at the half year, which results from lower expected return rates and increased debt cost within the live businesses, again in line with our expectations. I will come back to this shortly. The value of new business at 66 million was poor compared to the previous half year, with Lombard down 13 million, although they still had their second best ever first half, as John said. The U.K. showed initial signs of progress, increasing from 20 million in the first half of 2010 to 28 million in 2011. In international, which shows a reduction of 10 million year-on-year, the actual result was broadly flat when allowing for the change in new business valuation that we made at the end of  2010. Overall, the embedded value performed pretty much in line with assumptions in both the U.K. and in Lombard, with net positive operating variances of 1 million in aggregate for the two businesses. As already outlined, though, overall experience due to 16 million modeling errors in international was an overall loss of 15 million. The variance in international relates to a one-off adjustment, not an ongoing experience variance. Corporate income and charges, totaling 38 million, were also in line with expectations, comprised of 26 million of financing costs on non-life company instruments and 12 million of corporate costs net of their related investment income. To provide a fuller understanding, a summary of debt instruments and related interest on both the IFRS and MCV bases is included in the appendix. Returning then to the expected existing business contribution, I do suggest this is a slide you may wish to dwell on later rather than try and concentrate on the detail now. The snappily called EEBC is the expected profit from the unwind of the VIF at the risk-free rate, plus the additional expected earnings based on the business's long-term expectation of asset returns. For cash and government bonds, the one-year long-term expectation of returns is based on the one-year swap yield curve, effectively valuing returns at 1%, or 1.14% to be more accurate. The impact of all of this is that we're currently expecting the net worth to earn about 1% in the short term, a significant drag on operating earnings when your net assets represent over 45% of your total gross MCEV. This is consistent with our admittedly somewhat purist MCEV methodology. Had we based the business expectations on the 10-year swap rate at 3.7%, earnings for 6 months would have increased by approximately 40 million at the operating profit level, only to give rise to an adverse 40 million experience variance below the line. The one other factor the eagle-eyed amongst you may notice from this slide is that expected returns from bonds, equities and property have all reduced by over 0.5% compared to 2010 long-term rates. In view of recent market turmoil, this may well be a moot point, but it may help clarify why EEBC has reduced marginally compared to 2010 annualised levels, despite the increase in the value of in-force business. The MCEV profit after tax was 54 million. Total economic experience was a charge of 48 million, comprised of 28 million of exchange losses in international and Lombard, a 35 million reduction in MCEV from the mark-to-market of group debt, and 15 million of positive overall economic experience variances. Non-recurring costs were 79 million, as per IFRS, and the tax charge for the period was offset by the reduction in the rates of corporate tax announced in this year's budget. Looking briefly at the total development of MCEV, the value of the business benefited in the period from a 58 million profit on the BHA acquisition and 30 million of other items, primarily foreign exchange translation, resulting in a total MCEV of 6.7 billion. This reduced to 6.5 billion at 30th of June, reflecting the 141 million cash payment of the final 2010 dividend and 34 million returned to shareholders for the share buyback that commenced in June. After return of this 175 million to shareholders, The resulting MTV at 30 June is little changed from that at 31st December 2010, with gross MTV of $8 billion, debt of $1.5 billion, and a net EV of $6.5 billion. The MTV gearing has increased slightly to 19.3% from 18.7% at the year end. This reflects the additional $500 million of debt raised in the period, the subsequent repayment of the $400 million acquisition finance facility, the $63 million scheduled repayment of the deferred consideration notes, and an increase in the mark-to-market value of debt. Turning then to capital and cash. In June, we updated the market on our cash and capital position and our plans, stating that we had an estimated IGCA surplus at 3rd of June of $1.9 million. This has increased slightly at 30th of June to $2 billion, reflecting an increase in expected surplus to the extent that it's not retained in the life companies prior to the year-end valuation. The increase of $100 million, offset by other charges of $61 million, primarily the one-off and non-recurring costs, is the amount that's increased in the period. The end June position also benefited from the negative reserves implementation. The reduction from the start of the year of approximately $300 million is due to the $350 million dividend paid to Resolution, IGCA is measured at the Friends Life level, and the acquisition of BHA, in addition to the movements since the 3rd of June I just outlined. In the current volatile markets, the robustness of the surplus is clearly key. Our sensitivity testing estimated that a 40% fall in equity markets from the levels seen at the end of June would only reduce the surplus by 0.1 billion. An increase in interest rates of 100 bips across the yield curve would reduce the surplus by even less. This robustness is underpinned by the strength of the shareholder assets. Shareholder and non-profit assets account for 10.3 billion of the 101 billion of total assets. Of this amount, 8.4 billion is held in corporate bonds and asset-backed securities, and only 4% of which are non-rated or sub-investment grade, a slight improvement from the 5% reported at the year end. Looking at this slightly differently, only 0.2 billion, or a quarter of 1% of shareholder and non-profit assets, are sovereign debt or domestic bank debt of the European countries whose economies are considered the most vulnerable: Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece and Spain. A further 0.3 billion is in respect of non-domestic financials or domestic non-financials of these countries, with a significant element of this representing debt securitised by UK assets, such as airports and banks. As a result, we believe there is very limited direct threat to the robustness of our capital from these exposures. Returning then to IGCA, in our June update, we set out the basis on which we would seek to manage the IGCA surplus, including a buffer of $400 million held to support Resolution debt and shareholder commitments. The balance of the $800 million surplus, over and above our capital policies, was recognised as working capital to support ongoing investment and the delivery of our distributable cash target. No surplus capital was identified beyond these two elements. At the 30th of June, surplus capital on the same basis amounted to $150 million as a result of the achievement of the $100 million of capital synergies and the free surplus generated in the period, again to the extent that it's not required to be held in the long-term funds pending year-end valuation. IGCA working capital in the period reduced by $35 million from $400 million as a result of the investment in integration and separation made in the first half of the year. Moving on then to my favourite subject, the only element of any life business that one can genuinely value consistently: cash. Just a quick reminder, our definition of cash, available shareholder cash, is cash that has to be paid up or at least declared as a dividend by the life companies. It's not always is not required to support the capital base of the company, allowing for our capital policies, and is in liquid or near liquid form. Having clarified that, you can see that available shareholder cash reduced from $1067 million at the start of the year to $793 million at the end of June. This reduction reflects the payment of corporate costs, $22 million, the scheduled repayment and interest on the deferred consideration notes of $86 million, and returns to shareholders of $166 million. The payments to shareholders comprise $25 million in respect of the share buyback and $141 million for the 2010 final dividend. No cash was paid up from the life companies in the period. Typically, cash is only released as part of the year-end valuation. To get an indication of the cash that may be available at the year-end, I propose a quick look at the generation of free surplus. But please remember, life company free surplus is not cash. You can't spend it. During the first 6 months of the year, free surplus increased from $728 million to $1,105 million. Operating free surplus generated in the period was $283 million, $161 million of which was contributed by the implementation of PSO 614. Excluding this one-off, therefore, operating free surplus generated at the Friends Life Group level was $122 million for the 6 months. The $283 million represents the expected contribution towards our distributable cash target. In addition to the $400 million commitment we have made in respect of annual distributable cash, in 2011 we set an additional cash generation target of $235 million from the Capital Optimisation Programme. Our overall distributable cash target for 2011, including capital synergies, is therefore $635 million. One-off costs, economic experience variances and resolution corporate costs in aggregate reduced free surplus by $79 million, and a further $165 million was used to fund the BHA acquisition. The most significant impact of free surplus on the period was the $500 million of Tier 2 debt, that's $3 million of costs, raised by Friends Life. This effectively increased free surplus, as debt issued and guaranteed in the life businesses is part of required capital, whereas debt in the holding companies was part of free surplus. Finally, there was a reduction in surplus as a result of cash return to shareholders, primarily the 2010 final dividend. The interim dividend declared for 2011 is 6.47 pence per share, an increase of 18.5% on the interim last year. The final dividend is anticipated to be a recommendation of approximately 13.3 pence per share, though this will vary depending on the number of shares cancelled as a result of the share buyback programme. Based on this guidance, full year yield at last night's close would be 7.4%. As previously advised, the directors will continue to review the appropriateness of moving to a progressive dividend by the end of the project. In summary then, we believe that we're making good progress with the integration of the business, which remains robust in current volatile markets. Cash generation is improving, and we remain confident in our ability to meet our cash return commitments to shareholders. I'll now hand you over to Andy, who's keen to share his initial views on the Friends Life business.
Thank you, Jim. Good morning, everyone. I'm now 11 weeks in as Chief Executive at Friends Life, and as you might imagine, I've been quite busy. So I've visited 18 sites across seven different countries. I've met with over 50 of our major distribution partners and have over 20 deep dive sessions with my team into key areas of the business. So I'm starting to build a good understanding of the business and wanted today to start to share some initial impressions. As you know, there'll be a further update in November, where in more detail, where we'll be expanding on the steps we're taking to improve the profitability across the business. And my objective in November will be to leave you with a clear understanding of why Friends Life has an exciting and sustainable future, both in terms of generating profitable new business growth and in cash generation from our existing businesses. So initial impressions. Well, overall, I've been impressed with what I've seen. We're making good progress, but there is still a lot more we need to do to drive the performance of the business. That said, we've got some significant strengths, and I can see considerable opportunity for the business going forward. So in terms of strengths, our strategic direction is clear. We set it out in February, and I'm fully supportive of it. I've been impressed with the strength of our propositions and our distributor relationships. They leave us well placed to drive profitable new business growth. I'm encouraged by the progress we're making on integration so far. I know from experience there's still an awful lot to do, but we've made a good start. And finally, there's a considerable amount of market change in the UK life sector, and I believe we're well placed for that. In terms of opportunities, we clearly need to focus on improving the profitability of our UK new business. There's also an opportunity for us to increase value from the products we're no longer actively marketing for new business, and hence we're announcing today that we're creating our UK heritage business to focus on this. And tying both these together, there's an opportunity for us to create a structure with clearer accountabilities with three aims. Firstly, to support both these opportunities. Secondly, to align to our strategy. And thirdly, to drive our financial targets. So before I get into our plans, let me explain why I think we're well placed for the regulatory and market changes that the life sector faces. Well, for me, it's pretty basic. We need to understand what we think will be the impact of the market changes, and then we need to identify where we can play and win. That's the basis of the strategic review we've undertaken, and that's led to us structuring the business focused on the three areas: corporate benefits, protection, and retirement income. So let's start with corporate benefits. Automatic enrolment will further fuel the already strong growth in this market. As a major player, Friends Life will be a winner here. The Retail Distribution Review, RDR, will stop new initial commission schemes, but we've already pulled out of that market segment. We will benefit, however, if initial commission on increments aligns to a more commercially viable level, and also if worksite continues to develop as a distribution channel. For protection, this product area is excluded from the RDR, and hence we expect growth as more advisors move into this area. Also, the life tax changes will create a level playing field where Friends Life is no longer at risk of disadvantage. For retirement income, this is already the largest and fastest growing profit pool in the UK, and automatic enrolment will further drive growth there. That's why we chose these markets, and it's also why we've withdrawn from bonds and individual pensions, where the Retail Distribution Review is expected to have an adverse impact. Finally, Solvency II is expected to impact on existing business, reducing capital requirements on savings and increasing capital requirements on annuities. Hence, our new UK heritage business is expected to be a winner from this. So that's where we want to play and why we're well placed in the changing market environment. Turning now to strategy. As I've said, there's an opportunity for us to get our structure and accountabilities aligned to our strategy, and then align those to driving the financial targets we've set. So we'll have three business units focused on the three areas of active UK new business participation: corporate benefits, protection, and retirement income. We'll have MDs for each of these businesses, and we're building strong capability here. But the key point here is that these businesses will only have the go-forward platforms within them, including the existing business on those platforms, but they will not have the legacy product lines. So there will be clean, focused businesses where, as John has already said, we're already largely achieving, or in some cases exceeding, our target unit profitability. Turning now to our UK heritage business, I've decided to create this business unit, which will focus on our product lines which we're no longer actively marketing for new business. This will cover the majority of our 5 million existing customers who originally joined the group through a whole range of brands, including Sun Life, Friends Provident, Equity and Law, London and Manchester, to name but a few. This business unit will have accountability for meeting those customer needs, including delivering good service, and doing that in a cost, capital and tax efficient way. In other words, P&L and balance sheet accountability. In my view, insurers have generally, across the market, been poor at meeting the ongoing needs of their existing customers. This new business unit will create a specific accountability and focus in this area, with all the complexities of the past picked up by the UK heritage business, keeping the other UK businesses clean and simple. Finally, we have our two international businesses, FBI and Lombard, where we're investing in building capability to drive strong financial performance. So we've got a clear strategy, and our structure aligns to that, ensuring crystal clear accountabilities. What I then want to do is to align that to our financial outputs, ensuring crystal clear accountability for the delivery of our financial targets. So we have three key financial outputs: cash, profitable new business, and costs, and you'll be familiar with the headline targets in these areas. But what does that mean for each of our businesses? Well, for Corporate Benefits, Protection, and Retirement Income, given they only have the go-forward platforms within those business units, where we're already largely achieving our target unit profitability, the focus will be on continuing that and then driving strong, profitable new business growth. The U.K. Heritage business is the main driver of cash generation, but it's also focused on reducing new business strain on those product lines that are already legacy products, or indeed those that we're withdrawing as part of this strategy, and improving the profitability of increments to those legacy products. And across all four of the U.K. businesses, the cost focus is on driving the synergy delivery. Finally, for our international businesses, the focus is on delivering the 50 million per annum cash dividend, enhancing the IRRs to the target level, and again, driving strong, profitable new business growth. So to summarize, we've identified clear market opportunities. We have a well-developed strategy focused on profitable growth, and we've aligned our structure to this strategy and to driving the delivery of our financial targets, ensuring clear accountability. So while there's still much to do to improve the profitability of the business, we're off to an encouraging start. And I'm looking forward to seeing you all again at the November Investor Day, where we'll be setting out our plans to drive this improved profitability in each of our businesses, leaving you with a clear understanding that Friends Life has an exciting and sustainable future in each of our three U.K. go-to-market businesses, our U.K. Heritage business, and our international businesses, where collectively we'll be driving strong long-term growth in profitable new business and strong cash generation. Thank you. Back to you, Mike.
Thank you very much, Andy. Just before we move to questions and answers, can I just give you a few words on the operating agreement and where we are with that? We've reconfirmed today that we see Resolution Limited as a single project vehicle, namely that it will focus solely on the U.K. Life project and its completion. Resolution Limited has now, the board of Resolution Limited has now agreed a set of principles with Resolution Operations, which will allow it to sponsor other projects and to provide advice to other entities, which will not conflict with the U.K. Life project. We currently anticipate that the circular will be with the shareholders sometime in October. So that's the latest update and where we are with that. So as we move to questions and answers, can I please ask you to state your name and your company as you ask your question? Let's start with Greg.
Yeah, I was trying
one
to not start
time,
with
Greg.
Is that I was actually at three questions there, and I thought, is it one or three? I'll take.
We'll go slowly if it's
poetic
three.
License three. All right, it's Greg Patterson, KBW. One is, I wonder if you could just give us what the sort of net client cash flows for the corporate pension business is in the first half. Second one, you made a comment about that you were spending money on developing mortality and various other systems with regard to UK annuities. Does that mean that you're excluding, now that you may take the step, any acquisitions in that space? The third one is, given that the legacy systems, IT systems, are already separated from the front end systems, and it's going to cost you money to split up the front end and the back end, separately list them with separate overheads, etc., and the market will probably just look through that type of split. Why would you want to go through an exercise of splitting up those two businesses?
Jim, do you want to lead on cash and corporate pensions?
Yeah, I think there was a net increase in corporate pensions up to 18 billion, so it was just above flat. And if you're actually talking the strain, then the net outflows and strain on corporate pensions during the period were 41 million. The net client cash flows were about 0.9 in aggregate.
Plus.
Who
I'm happy to take the other
would
two.
You please,
so,
Andy? Yeah.
So in terms of the annuity side, what we're doing is organically building the capability. We've made strong progress on this. So we've hired David Still as a managing director of the retirement income business. We've hired Richard Willits as director of longevity. Richard is, you know, pretty widely regarded as one of the few leading experts on longevity in the marketplace. So I wouldn't rule out acquisitions in any particular area, but we're confident that we can organically build the capability to play strongly in the annuity and retirement income space. In terms of your third question, Greg, that this is very much about a management exercise. So we believe that the needs of the customers and also the value drivers of the businesses in terms of the products that we're no longer actively marketing for new business compared to those that we are different. And therefore, we want to get different groups, management groups, focused on those. We do not expect a significant increase in our cost base by organising ourselves in that way.
So we work from the front and work back. Thank you, Sammy.
John Hocking, Morgan Stanley. I've got three questions, please. On the UK Heritage reorganisation, is this a sort of precursor, or does it give you optionality to treat these businesses as a sort of back book new business that you've spoken about? And if so, to what extent are they intertwined? You know, are they separable business units? Are they going to be legal entities? And a follow-up, are we going to see separate reporting for those four business units going forward? Are we going to get an allocation of the targets across the four business units? That's the first point. Second point, on the international EV modelling, is that something which we can treat as a closed issue? Can you comment on what it was? Have you already looked at Lombard? Is there any sort of follow-through there across the rest of the business? And then finally, on the IRRs, on the protection and retirement income segment, you already seem to be quite a long way ahead of where you targeted 2-3 years out. Are those targets too conservative, or is there some issue with protections you roll onto the new platform? Thank you.
John, do you want to take the first one, or do you, Andy?
Yeah, I'll deal with the first one. No, there is no kind of reading into that, really, to join the recent publicity that we are prioritising a split of the book. From the point of view of securing an exit, it's been one of the four options we set out in February and reaffirmed in both March and June when we spoke to the market. But this is very much Andy coming to us and saying, this is how I want to run the business from a management point of view, and for the reasons that he's just stated, that he gets the right level of incentives, the right level of support and people in those businesses. I guess that ultimately, should we choose to go that route, it helps to position it for that, for a separation. But that is a decision that clearly hasn't been taken. We're studying all those four options very deeply.
So those three new business units are self-financing. Are they being transferred cash from the Heritage business to Wright?
We'll cover all that at the November Investor Day. So it is our expectation that we will break down the the financials for the UK segment of the business between those four business units I've articulated, and that's what we'll look to start to cover more of in November.
Jim, do you want to take the modelling?
Yes, certainly. The first bit is, have we looked at Lombard? Yes. The international piece is actually part of the total finance transformation programme. So we're not just looking at international in isolation. We're actually looking at making sure we have robust models of cost piece as we enhance our infrastructure as part of the Solvency II programme. And therefore, within that, until we've finished that, we won't know whether there are any more pluses or minuses, but we have no reason to believe that there should be a net either way. But it is a refresh of the whole of the UK infrastructure, which international sat on, but had older models from when they were acquired.
Andy?
I'm happy to take the third question. So in terms of the IRRs on protection and retirement income, on protection, the BHA business has been significantly in income protection and critical illness and in the first 5 months of our ownership of that business. As we go forward, I would expect that product mix to evolve a little with more term insurance, which won't have as strong an IRR as that. So we wouldn't be increasing the guidance from the 20% we're aiming for as a target, and we would expect longer term to be nearer that 20% level. In terms of retirement income, again, no plans to increase the target there. In reality, as we start to drive increased business both on internal vestings and particularly in the open market option side, Clearly, we'd expect pricing to be one of the levers that we would look at within that, and that would have an impact through to IRRs. So it's encouraging that we've got that strong profitability on the target platforms, but don't expect those the high levels in the first half to be the benchmark going forward. We'd expect to be around the levels of the targets that we've indicated.
Lots of hands. Right, let's work from that. So it's Andrew first, and we'll work that way.
Good morning. It's Andrew Crean at Autonomous. Three questions. What's the EV of the heritage business? Secondly, the way you've constructed the $400 million cash target, I think you generate $400 million, $25 million goes to roll, and then $100 million goes to pay the interest and capital return on the AXA loan notes. Are there plans to replace the AXA loan notes with something some more longer term, so that the dividend capacity of the business can increase by that amount? And thirdly, could you just talk us through the journey from $393 million of cash strain to $193 million of cash strain, how you're doing at the moment? I mean, part of that, as I read it, was the adoption of PSA 614 across all your units, so that the strain as you write protection business reduced, and that would be about half of the reduction. Is that so, and is that what's coming through at the moment?
I think they're probably all for you, Jim, actually.
Yeah, in terms of the EV of the heritage unit, we're not in a position to say what that's going to be yet. We're just looking at the exact balance of that, and we will clearly look to put appropriate metrics in place with the market as and when we've had the chance to go through all of that work. In terms of the $400 million, I think your analysis is absolutely right, Andrew, in terms of where that sits. The position with the DC notes is that those would actually be restructured for something of a more permanent nature in the event that Friends Life were to return to the market or any other exit strategy, as they relate, there's a break point in those effectively for our ownership. So in time, the answer is yes. Clearly, with the markets where they are at the moment, you wouldn't expect to see anything in the very short term. And in terms of...
I'm happy to pick up the new business strain if you
okay,
want.
Fine.
Yeah. So 392 is the annualised 2010 figure, which we've committed to reduce by $200 million down to 192. In the first half, we were at about 160 million. So you can see we've started to make progress in the right direction. We'd want to get that 160 down to effectively 96 for the average half year. So we've got another 65 or so to go. That will basically be driven by both continued delivery of the cost synergies, but also the product strategy. So for example, if you take protection, we are still selling our Heritage Friends Provident and Heritage AXA protection products at the moment. They are high capital strain and low IRR, as you can see from the results. What we're looking to do in the fourth quarter of this year is to add some of the key features of those products onto the Heritage BHA platform and then withdraw the Heritage Friends Provident and Heritage AXA protection products from the IFA market in the fourth quarter of this year. So that'll be one of the other key drivers of bringing that new business strain down to the required levels.
The other thing I'd add to that, Andrew, if it helps, is that in the UK, which is clearly the biggest driver of the 200, the full baseline's 303 million, and the first 6 months of this year was 98. So you can see the progress made in the UK.
Okay, can we work along? Thank you.
Thank you. Morning. Raghu Hariharan from Citi. Just had three questions. The first question was on the corporate pensions book and the transfer of assets of $3.5 billion. So what proportion of your $18 billion would be on the NGP or the new generation platform? Would it be 100%? Would it be all of the 18 billion? I'm a bit confused as to what would be in the heritage side and what would be on your new business side.
So the majority is on the NGP. Again, we will cover the specifics of that at the November Investor Day.
Okay. Thank you. The second question was just if you could split the IRRs between the back book and the new book. So what is the IRR on the heritage book? And how is that different from the IRRs that you're quoting on new business? I'm just wondering whether the heritage book will cross-subsidize your new business in terms of expenses and strain. And the third question was really on Solvency II. Clearly, with the delay, which is probably 2014, a year's delay, how does that affect capital return or capital synergy extraction for the business?
Do you want to
Given that you will be in a better position.
Who wants to take the IRRs? Andy or
I'm happy to take the
you
IRRs.
You do that, and Jim will do the Solvency II.
So the IRRs for the go forward businesses are basically the IRRs for the target platforms, which we've communicated in the results today. The IRRs on the back book, clearly that's going to evolve over time because we're still in the process of withdrawing some of the products as part of the strategy. But the point for me is that the UK heritage business is not just about driving the cash generation from the existing business that's already on the books. It's about dealing with the new business strain on the legacy products and those products that we're still withdrawing as part of the strategy and improving the profitability of the increments there as well. So that's going to be a key area of focus as part of that. And then the corporate benefits, the protection and the retirement income businesses are the clean go-forward businesses just focused on those target platforms.
In terms of Solvency II, I still don't think we know the date, but the essence on Solvency II, as we've said in our statement today, is that we are confident that on the current basis of the rules, the level of surplus that we had would be more than on a Pillar 1 basis. And therefore, we are keen to support the movement, given the investment that's gone into it, and more the stability will have given comparability across the industry. So we're very keen to see the implementation of that. But we can't comment today on what the impact of that delay will be because we don't know what the rules are going to be or when the delay is going to be.
Just keep working along, please. Thank you.
Thanks. It's Gordon Aitken from Royal Bank of Canada. Just one question on corporate pensions. You're obviously winning schemes and you're losing schemes. Just can you comment on why you're winning those schemes and why you're losing schemes? What are the pension schemes themselves telling you? And can you comment on, I mean, you've got one... Well, some major competitors still paying a lot of commission, and you've also got a competitor which is spending a lot of money upgrading its product. And comment on to which extent you know both of those are a factor.
Happy to. Why we're winning? Well, we participate in the Greenwich Survey, which is, in our view, the leading survey of employee benefit consultants that looks at the strengths surveys employee benefit. Consultants in terms of the strengths of service and proposition, and Friends Life comes out as the leader in that survey. So the reason we win is basically we have very strong propositions, relationships with EBCs, and strong service delivery. The reason we lose is invariably on price because we apply some quite strong financial disciplines which a number of our competitors don't. In terms of the initial commission market, our view is the economics of that market are unattractive and hence we don't want to participate. In terms of spend on systems, we are also ourselves investing on our systems as we have done historically, and that's why we deliver both strong service and strong unit costs on our go-forward platform for corporate pensions.
Good. We're done on that, Lauren. Right. I think it's... James.
Morning. James Pearce from UBS. Just one question. In your statement, Mike, you say that it's going to be harder to make the double-digit IRR given the sector multiple. I think in the past you've said that your IRR for the project is not dependent on a re-rating. It feels like you're more inclined to look to the market for an exit now than corporate buyers. Could you just talk around that issue and why you're slightly more cautious?
I don't think that's absolutely correct. But Jim, do you want to just pick it up and I'll follow on?
The core essence of the statement is... Given that the markets had fallen 30-odd% for the life sector in the state of, 4 weeks, and the volatility we've seen around that, it would have, I think, been somewhat naive to say that those returns could be met in absolutely any circumstances. Equally, if you took it the other way and you look at recent market prices of 85%, for instance, then you would see a very different answer. So it is purely to point out that extreme volatility could ultimately have an impact on the level of returns. It's not an exact science.
And has your view on whether the exit will be a corporate exit or... market exit changed?
I don't think our view on exit has changed at all. John has already outlined there are a number of options for exit and we will continue to develop the business the way that allows us to optimise that for the benefit of the shareholders.
But I think what I would add to that, James, is that that whilst we would select the option or the best combination of options that gives shareholder maximum value, the time frame for that exit we think is still the one that we set out at the beginning. Which, if you roll 5 years forward from November 2009, is by 2014.
So just to recap, we've not changed our view. We're just recognising the fact that we've just been through a period of extreme volatility, that's all. Just keep on working along that line. Thank you.
Hi, thanks so much. Andy Hughes, Exane BNP Paribas. Two questions, if I could. First one is on the restructuring of the with the heritage business. If I was an advisor hearing this today, I'd probably be very worried about the service standards for the back book. Obviously, it's crucially important, given RDR, that service standards are maintained. I mean, is that one of the reasons why you're doing this? You're going to go back to advisors and say, don't worry about the service on the back book. That's our heritage business. Actually focus on the service on the new book. And the second question is in respect of the DB to DC switch that I think you highlighted on your slides. Obviously, these things called enhanced transfer values as DB schemes mature and de-risk, potentially a huge market for group pensions providers. However, I noticed that Scottish Widows, for example, don't participate in this market at all. So I was wondering what your view was on the prospects for enhanced transfer values. Thank you.
Andy, I think they're both yours.
Yeah, sure. So in terms of service standards on the UK heritage business, we are very focused on delivering good service to all our customers, all 5 million customers within Friends Life, including those in the UK heritage business. The reason we are is a number of reasons. Two key reasons would be, first of all, in my experience, it's more cost effective to deliver customers good service than get it wrong. Frankly, it costs more if you get the service wrong. Secondly, a key value driver for that UK heritage business from a shareholder perspective is retention, particularly through and capturing a bigger proportion of the £2 billion of maturing pension monies each year. And again, the quality of service is important within that. In terms of the DB to DC shift in the market and enhanced transfer values, that is a market we're participating in. We think that there's a significant customer need because from an employer's perspective, it's attractive to start to reduce the level of their DB liability and get certainty. And obviously from the employee's perspective, they then have the option of moving across with the enhanced transfer value into a DC arrangement. So we think that's an attractive market going forward.
How big that market might be, the enhanced transfer value?
Again, that's something we'll talk more about in November.
Thank you. Jane, perhaps you can. Thank you.
Hi, it's Toby Langley from Barclays Capital. I've got three questions. On the new business between legacy and target platforms, there's still quite a considerable portion in the first half written on the legacy platform. So when do you expect the maximum proportion to be written on the target platforms? Is that something we should expect in the second half? Are we going to be waiting for that into next year? And then with regard to the Bupa platform itself, what in particular makes that so much better? Is it purely a case of product mix, or is there something that's maybe you're not talking about so openly at the moment within the release? And then on the auto-enrollment market, you're not really alone in terms of getting excited about that market and the potential for growth there. And I'm wondering if you can give me your sense of what expected opt-out rates are going to be within that market.
Okay.
After you.
So in terms of the first question, new business on legacy platforms, that will vary in different areas. So on corporate benefits, we're no longer selling new schemes onto the Heritage AXA platforms, but we will, for a considerable period of time, continue to get new increments and new entrants. In terms of protection, so as I've said already, for the IFA market, we're planning to close the Heritage Friends Provident and Heritage AXA products to new business in the fourth quarter of this year. So don't expect a significant shift in those numbers in H2 of this year, because it's towards the end of the year we're making that change. And then from the controlled distribution perspective, much of that will be into next year. Again, we'll give you much more colour on that in November. Why is the BHA platform financials more attractive? A number of reasons. We have a strong product proposition. We have a stronger business mix in terms of critical illness and income protection. We have lower costs, both in terms of the processing costs, because we've got an efficient platform in place. But also, we've run the BHA business with a much more focused distribution strategy, focused on key distributors in the market, and hence our sales and marketing and acquisition costs are more attractive on the BHA platform as well. Finally, in terms of automatic enrolment, I'm not going to get drawn into that today. Again, we'll talk more about that in November, but clearly that's something we're actively looking at and working on.
Trevor.
Thank you. It's Trevor Moss from Berenberg. like to ask Andy, I guess, whether he thinks it's a strategic disadvantage not to have owned asset management, particularly in the corporate pensions arena, where a number of competitors obviously take some decent margins into their asset management business. The second question relates to disclosure. I think, Ian, you've dropped the line of business IFRS disclosure, which has strain and surplus, so that we've built our models on that basis, I think, some of us. And that's been dropped for the first half. If you could explain why that's been done, and secondly, to tell us how you're going to report going forward, given the new business line setup that Andy's outlined.
Andy, you want to start?
Sure, yeah. No. So in terms of the asset management side, to be honest, our focus initially is on the fixed income capability to support the retirement income and annuity business, and we will be looking to build our capability in terms of fixed income and credit from an asset management perspective. Beyond that, I don't see it's a significant disadvantage, but it is something that we may well consider in time in terms of the opportunity from an asset management perspective.
Jim?
Yeah, thanks, Trevor. In terms of the disclosures, we've aligned our disclosures against the product lines that are our strategic lines. I think all of that information should still be there by product line, and it's in the individual segments of the business review. So I'm not sure which bit you're actively missing in the models.
You were giving by line of business, so for example, pensions, annuities, etc., both strain and surplus.
Yep.
So you had an IFRS profit by line of business, and you did that both for Friends Provident and for the AXA business at year end. But I don't see that in the disclosure unless I'm missing it somewhere.
We've certainly given the strain numbers by individual products, but
you haven't given them the surplus. That's my point.
No particular reason for doing that. We just try to focus on the strategic rationale of going forward. If it's particularly helpful for you, we can look at whether that's information we can issue.
Okay.
So we'll look at that, will we? And I guess if we think it should have been part of the announcement, we'll make it. We'll make an announcement.
Well, you know, it was important enough to disclose.
No, it's a fair point. Right, let's move back a row, please.
Thank you. Duncan Russell from JP Morgan Cazenove. I was just wondering if you could give us some sensitivities for the equity market drop since the half year, what impact that will have on your embedded value and on your IFRS profits. Some sort of sensitivity analysis there, please. Secondly, then, within the free surplus movement, you gave a figure of 122 underlying development. There's a 79 million below the line. Just wondering how much of that is genuinely one-off and how much is recurring. And then finally, could you just give us the Friends Provident standalone IFRS operating profit for the first half so we could just see how the acquisitions are performing, etc. Thanks.
Jim?
Yeah, in terms of the 122 and the 79, the 122 is effectively pure operating. The 79 are the one-off costs that I ran through. So to the extent that those relate to integration costs and separation costs, they are clearly something that we've highlighted within the models. In terms of the elements that relate to the ongoing finance transformation, we would expect to see some costs reoccur in the short term, so we would expect some further costs coming through that in the second half of the year. In terms of Friends Provident standalone, we're not able to give that information for the operating profit because we don't manage the business in that in any way anymore, and new business is already integrated and other elements of the business are transferred across. So we don't have a Friends Provident business standalone to report against anymore. In terms of the sensitivities have changed very little from the sensitivities that we gave at the beginning of the year. In terms of the volatility of markets, therefore, they've performed very much in that. So in the region of current position, we may be roughly 300 million on equities alone basis, but it does depend very much on the rate at which markets move.
Andrew, we're working back down to the front again.
Andrew Green again, is Autonomous. You give the VIF maturity profile, I think, on a MCEV basis. If you were to do it as others do it, on a real-world basis, would it change materially for you? And am I right in thinking, broadly speaking, when I'm trying to divine your heritage businesses, those would be the with profits, the investment business, and a portion of the pensions business, i.e. the personal element?
The second element is broadly yes. But to the extent that it makes sense to make sure that products are no longer sold, they fit with heritage, to ensure that we provide the appropriate focus on both returns and policyholder submission, then exactly where that line will fall will move as we migrate the business onto the strategic platforms. And therefore, I think that's the appropriate way forward with that. In terms of the VIF, we haven't actually disclosed what the implication would be, and we're not in a position to do so on real-world rates because we don't actually know the basis on which those are going to be set going forward. And it could be material, as I've already said, on the expected return, depending on where you cut those real-world rates, which is why we use the risk-free.
Andy, I don't think we answered Trevor's question about asset management.
Okay, I thought
you did.
I did.
You did.
To your satisfaction? Yeah?
Well, I don't know if it's to my satisfaction.
Okay. Fair enough. Any other questions? Just a quick. Another three?
Sorry, Greg Patterson, KBW. I'm not sure, it might be somewhere in there, but just on the corporate tax changes, have you capitalised all the benefits in the EV yet? And if not, how much would go? Must we add if it gets down to the 23%?
The answer to your question is yes, we have on the EV, and that's what the final move was this time. So currently the EV reflects the budget.
But that means up 3 years' time?
Correct.
Right, well, there seem to be no other questions. Can I thank you very much, everybody, for coming along today, and travel back safely. Thank you.